Now you are very welcome back to Tuesday's Richie Allen Show. The old voice is struggling today. You get days like that, you know. You get days like that. And I think I'll need a cold beer after the programme. The studio is only roasting. Shall we give Tony Gosling a bell? Let's give him a bell. Top man is Tony Gosling. You know him, of course, from the Politics Show in Bristol. Terrific show, thisweek.org.uk. A few weeks ago, Tony said to me, he said, Richie, what do you know about Martin Bormann? Of course, I had to tell the truth. Not a lot. You're a history graduate, I know. I know that he was a bastard. I know he was a dreadful, dreadful human being. Private secretary to Adolf Hitler. Wielded extraordinary influence in the party and over Adolf Hitler. Party to genocide. Key decision maker. And officialdom, or official sources will tell you, that he fled Berlin in May of 1945. After Hitler killed himself, Bormann apparently fled Berlin, tried to flee Berlin anyway to avoid capture, you see, by the Russians. That's how it goes. We are told that he probably committed suicide on a bridge. And that was the end of him. And back in 1998, I believe, DNA testing claimed that it was indeed Bormann, and Bormann was dead and had died on a bridge back in 1945. End of story. But some people think that was the beginning of the story. Maybe he didn't commit suicide on a bridge in 1945. Tony Gosling's a terrific journalist, great broadcaster and writer, formerly of the BBC. He's a politics show on Bristol's BCFM, which you can find out all about at thisweek.org.uk. Is a must-listen radio show every Friday. Delighted to welcome him back to the country and the programme. It's our pal Tony Gosling. How you doing, Tony?
Oh, not too bad, Richie. Yeah, thanks very much for your intro. I mean, one of the things I do is, I mean, when I was working at the BBC, I first joined them in 1989, and there was still this real go-getting attitude, like, we are totally independent, at least amongst some people, and we are going to be calling anyone that causes any trouble in this world of ours to account. And that attitude, that state of mind, that spirit was still alive in the BBC. Now, I'm not saying it's completely gone, because, for example, tonight there's a documentary on BBC Scotland about Ewan Cameron, the guy who was the scientist behind MK Ultra. So that, I believe, is an hour and a half documentary. So there's still a bit of it about. But most of the people, like me, who were digging in places where, for example, I was working in Salisbury when I finally got sacked, digging into Ted Heath and possible links to the, because he lived in Salisbury, and child abuse going on in children's homes there, you know, it was never provable that that was why my contract was never renewed, but the problem is here, you can't, you know, that seemed to me now, looking back on it, it was quite obvious. You know, I was trying to get some approval from the editors and the managers to go with this story that we've got, and found, it's only a little tin pot local radio station, but then I found myself out of my ear, Richie.
Yeah, there's no doubt it was your looking into former Prime Minister Edward Heath and what he was doing there. There's no doubt about it. Here's the $64 million question. I know you'll be honest. Knowing what you know now, to preserve your job and maybe do some good, would you have backed away from the Heath stuff to keep your job?
Well, I wasn't really given an option, but no. The answer, of course, is no.
Good
because
man.
How can you sit there and, you know, talk about the latest bottle bank being installed in the town when you know that there's a sort of dark heart at the centre of the goings on there. I mean, the other thing about this Bormann story is the thing, and you've actually just prompted this in my mind, you know, because you pointed out quite rightly about the evidence that came to light in big inverted commas in the 1990s
yeah.
about Bormann's body being discovered, blah, blah. Is that there were two occasions in the last century when there was big news stories about, oh, they've discovered his body in Berlin, or they've discovered proof that this really was his body. The first was when Stuart Stephen, who's a former Bristol journalist working at the Daily Express, exposed along with Ladislas Farago, who's a Hungarian journalist, that Bormann was alive in South America, and they had a photograph of him in 1972. It was literally within 2 weeks, the story then came out, oh, we've discovered his body in Berlin, this can't be true. And that was in 1972, at the end of 72. And then at the end of, I think it was 96, when this second revelation about, oh, we've definitely concluded that this is definitely his skull. Well, that was just after the publication of a book called Op JB, which is subtitled The Last Great Secret of the Second World War, by Christopher Crichton, who used that name because he didn't want to use his real name because he was worried even though he was in his 70s that he might be done under the Official Secrets Act. So, you know, you can see what happens here. As the truth starts to emerge, so the lies come along like a giant sledgehammer and smash it down. And I'm really, you know, I've seen so many examples of this in this story. It's just like a kind of goldmine story. And there are two main books around it. I just mentioned Op JB, and I never met him before. He died 2 or 3 years ago, John Ainsworth Davis, the author of that. But I met his wife and, you know, had long chats with her about the whole thing. I'm absolutely convinced that it's a true story, just simply because I've seen the way that there's been attempts over the years to cover it up. So that's really the first story of Bormann is in that book, Op JB. And that came out in the 90s, but a decade before, in a weird way, it's kind of in reverse, right? Because that tells the story of Bormann being brought from Berlin under the noses of the Russians by commandos along canals and rivers into the British sector. And then he kind of disappears for a while. And apparently there's an 800-page dossier, which has probably been burnt now, but I wonder if anyone kept copies of it, which is a debriefing of Bormann, where he tells his entire story of what happened in the Second World War, his rise to power. But then there's an American, sorry, Canadian journalist. No, he's an American, sorry. A guy called Paul Manning that picks up the story because he then discovers, he was one of the top journalists of World War II working for CBS on the radio like I used to be. And then he writes a book called Martin Bormann, Nazi in Exile, which then talks about what Bormann was up to. And Richie, I've never been so surprised by my YouTube interview I did with Talk Radio Europe back in February 2016, which was only, I think it was only about 25 minutes or something, 20 minutes. And it's, I put it up online. It was called What the BBC Won't Tell You About Brexit. And it was really a review of that book, Martin Bormann, Nazi and Exile. It talks about basically a financial Fourth Reich. So the idea here is that the Germans, the Nazis, had developed this technique whereby the banks could basically buy up a whole country's infrastructure and use that to take over the country rather than using armed force. And they did that to a large extent before they attacked the Low Countries and France. Much of the French, this is what he describes, this was a technique that Bormann was using. And the idea was to carry this on after the Second World War, to create a financial empire, a financial Fourth Reich, finance massive things like pharmaceutical companies. And the evidence is, I think, that's exactly what they've done. Basically, that money that Bormann had control of, around about $1 billion at the end of the war, which was a hell of a lot of money.
In gold, wasn't it, Tony? Was it? A lot of it was in gold bullion, no?
Yep, a lot of it was, but a lot of it was also securities for firms, what they call bearer bonds, which are basically like banknotes, but they're share certificates that can be passed from hand to hand.
Right.
And these were squirreled away down in Switzerland. And Op JB tells the story of how Ian Fleming flew to Switzerland to try and find out who had control of all these Nazi assets towards the end of the war. But that's, you know, jumping ahead a little bit. I think, you know, the main thing about the Op JB book is describing this guy, John Ainsworth Davis, being basically groomed as a double agent to then be sent in at the end of the war to get Bormann out. I mean, he talks, for example, about in October 1940 going over to Donegal and destroying two U-boats that were being refueled there as a way to sort of get himself known to the Germans. And then after that, he then said, well, actually, I'd do anything for money. And that's when he started his career as a double agent. He was then, in 1942, he was involved in the Dieppe raid, Operation Jubilee. He said, well, if you pay me, I will tell you when the raid on Dieppe is going to be. And so he was actually interrogated by Rommel, who explained to him, look, you know, if you he had him on the coast. This is what he says in the book. He had him on the coast with a gun to his head and saying, look, if this raid doesn't arrive, we're just going to shoot you now and throw you over the cliff. This is in 19th of August 1942. 10,000 troops arrived to do a raid on Dieppe. It was supposed to be a great success and to prove to Stalin that he wasn't having to fight the war on his own. Well, because it was betrayed by John Ainsworth Davis, it meant that those 10,000 troops, 1,500 of them roughly died, 500 were wounded, almost all Canadians. But of course, this was something that I suppose that the Brits felt they could do to the Canadians. So that was Operation Jubilee, 19th of August 1942. And by that act, really, he proved to himself, or he proved to the Germans that he was working for them. But of course, he was actually a double agent, and so many people were sacrificed just to prove to the Germans that this guy was good. And then after that, Slapton Sands cover up, he talks about that, where 1,000 died because a pre-D-Day operation on the 28th of April 1944 was raided by some German E-boats, and 1,000 sailors and soldiers died in that. But that was all covered up during the war. And then he goes on to talk about the, you know, much more interesting, I think, the really swan song, which was this OPJB from the 1st to the 11th of May 1945, Operation James Bond, which he talks about at the end of the book. Well, really, it's the key thing in the book, because to bring Bormann out, do it entirely secretly, and then to cover up all the documents afterwards was an incredible thing to do.
Right, let's take this step by step, because I reviewed the documents on politicsthisweek.wordpress.com. Thank you very much. Tony Gosling is our guest. I would imagine that my Irish listeners, I can only imagine, when you said Donegal and a U-boat being blown up, their ears went to the sky, and you said that this was the guy who wanted to prove himself to the Germans, the guy that was going to actually carry out the operation to get Bormann out. So let's go back to the very beginning then and take this step by step. We've got an hour from here. If you want to. Tony Gosling is our guest, top man, journalist, great friend of mine, been speaking on this programme and others for many, many years. And I'm fascinated by this story. I talked about Martin Bormann earlier on. People don't get more odious than this guy, a genocidal maniac. And it's believed that he committed suicide on a bridge in 1945 to avoid capture. But there is real doubt that maybe that didn't happen. Now, Tony said to me, actually, about a week or two ago, Tony said, Richie, when I come on to talk about this, he said, I want you to do what you do and have a go at me. I'm not going to, D. I'm not going to, because it's fascinating. I'm not going to have a go at you at all. My listeners are not stupid. They'll make their own minds up. I think it's fascinating and it's brilliant. And I'm loving it. And of course, when I said you were coming on today to talk about this, you saw the Twitter thing. It went mental with people going up. I totally believe that Bormann didn't die and he was taken out. Right. Step by step, Tony. This guy is a madman. Why would people in the West, why would people, operatives or politicians in the UK or elsewhere, why would they want to let this guy off the hook? Now, I know you talked about him having control of bullion. I know you said he had securities, Tony. That makes a bit of sense to me. But couldn't they just steal that stuff from him? So why were they prepared to get into bed with this nutcase, this scumbag, and save him, basically, and rescue him from his, well, undoubtedly his fate was to be swinging at the end of a rope after Nuremberg. So why?
Okay, the main reason was what Ian Fleming discovered when he flew over to Switzerland just before the operation, which was that this guy's signature was what they needed. The thing is that the loot was all secreted, almost all of it, in Switzerland. There's no way the Swiss authorities are just going to let anybody come along and take that. I mean, they can kill Bormann, but what's that going to get them? If they don't kill him, they can start doing deals with him. He has a lot of cards up his sleeve, Richie. One of the most important cards is the nuclear program that the Germans had been doing. Now, if you think about all the names of the nuclear scientists, the nuclear weapon that Churchill was so afraid was going to be stuck on the end of a V2 and dropped on London, it's quite plausible, and there's a lot of evidence for the accumulation in Nazi Germany of enriched uranium. They had the technology to do it. They had the heavy water plant up in Norway in order to help with the bomb making, and that it's quite clear. Actually, this has come out only over the last few years. I mean, it's amazing way that stuff emerges such a long, long time afterwards. It is that there was a sighting actually in Germany of nuclear. This is, I think it was in the Daily Express about a year ago, the first time I ever saw it, of the, various witnesses saying that they saw a mushroom cloud in Germany.
In Germany.
If this is true, and it's entirely possible that it is, if this is true, this means that actually the very first nuclear test wasn't conducted by the Americans and the Manhattan Project. It was conducted by the Nazis. Now, this doesn't, it might sound, you know, intuitively, oh, no, that can't be possible. Well, think of all of the names of all of the nuclear bomb scientists, the nuclear scientists. The atom was first split by the German scientists. And, you know, even Frisch and Pyles, these are the two guys at Birmingham University that designed in 1940 the first atomic bomb, which Churchill said, well, we haven't really got the capability to build it in Britain. And he sent all those people over to the US as part of something called the Quebec Agreement to build it over there. But they were both, one was Austrian, the other one was German. These are the designers of the bomb in Birmingham in 1940.
So you think the Germans might have been ahead? You think the Germans might have even been ahead or way ahead of their American counterparts in developing what we call the atomic bomb?
Definitely. I don't think there's any doubt about that now. There's lots of evidence has emerged of the fact that there was a program in the US to build an atomic weapon. Why was Churchill so, I mean, if you go through, there's various books about the sort of technical side and the scientific side of the war. And you will see Churchill, you know, he really was worried that there was going to, because the V2 was arriving on London, and at any minute one of those could have an atom bomb on it. I mean, of course, the top people in Britain and in the United States were aware that this was possible. But anyway, so that was an enormous bargaining chip. And one of the things that I've discovered through interviewing Carter Heydrich, who's the author of a book called Critical Mass: How Nazi Germany Surrendered Enriched Uranium for the U.S. Atomic Bomb. Was that they had actually quite a lot of in fact, what he says in the book is the evidence that he's dug out from the US archives is 560 kilos of enriched uranium went onto this submarine called U-235, and it was heading to Japan very slowly, chugging just under the sea at the end of the war. And of course, Hitler handed on power to Dönitz. So Dönitz, once Bormann had done his deal in London, and the dates are incredible here. So Bormann was delivered, according to the OpJB book, Bormann was delivered to Desmond Morton, who was Winston Churchill's private secretary in the British sector in Germany, on the 11th of May, 1945. Well, it was the night of the 12th and the 13th of May that this submarine carrying this enriched uranium, U-235 was the name of the submarine, would you believe? Oh, no, sorry. No. U-234 was the name. It's easy to get confused. U-234 was the number of the submarine, and the enriched uranium was U-235, 560 kilos of it encased in gold in drums. That submarine suddenly stopped. The two Japanese officers on it, Hideo Tomonaga and Lieutenant Genzo Soji, were then either shot or committed suicide, and then the submarine changed course and started heading to Portsmouth Naval Base in the US. So there is one little potential deal that Bormann did when he got to Britain, is to make sure that the Japanese didn't get that enriched uranium for an atomic bomb, and the Americans did instead. So you can see the high stakes that were going on.
This is fascinating, Tony. And look, it's plausible. It doesn't mean it's true, but it's plausible, and it's very interesting. Well, it's beyond very interesting. So let's talk about Bormann again in terms of these wouldn't have been conversations Bormann would have had in 1945. Who knows how long Bormann was having conversations with representatives of the British government or British intelligence or US intelligence. It could have been going back two, three, 4 years, Tony.
Well, look, and also, I mean, I've spoken to people who I've got contacts who are connected with the Nazi community in Argentina after World War II. And many of them are just ordinary people like you and me. You know, they've just been sort of told stuff by grandparents and things. One of the other things that was handed over to the Americans in that submarine, and this is also in Carter Heydrich's book, is the fuses that were necessary to explode a plutonium bomb. So, you know, there was the uranium bomb first at Hiroshima, and the other bomb at Nagasaki was a plutonium bomb. So they wanted to try both of them out. In fact, of course, we now know that they didn't really need to use either of them. And there's a whole load of literature around, you know, why, what happened to Roosevelt? Why did he die? And why did Truman then pop up and suddenly say, yes, let's try this bomb out? Anyway, so the fuses for plutonium were particularly awkward because plutonium has to be compressed into a critical mass very, very quickly. You can't just stick it in a, what they use this kind of bullet thing in the uranium bomb. Where you just fire these two into each other. No, the whole thing has to be imploded in a sphere very, very fast. And they couldn't find a way to get the electricity to all the explosives to make this thing implode fast enough. But the Germans had developed an infrared system of fuses to wrap around the sphere of plutonium. And they were also on this submarine, apparently. So, you know, there's a whole load of technology. I mean, of course, there may have been other stuff we still don't know about.
And Borman had access to this. This is why I asked that question about, did Borman switch sides in the early 1940s? Did Borman see the writing was on the wall for the Fourth Reich and... Did he switch sides? Because...
I don't think he had any sides. He's just one of these, like, mafia-style characters that's working for whoever is going to give him the most. I mean, you know, I don't think he had any particular principles.
No, of course
although
not.
It does seem he particularly hated Jews. He was a very, very key person.
He hated Christians, too, it must be said.
What he'd done was he created this thing called the Wannsee Conference. In fact, he organized the whole thing, which took place just near Berlin. And that was towards the end of the war. It was on the 20th of January, 1942, actually halfway through. But what they decided to do at that conference was basically to agree a plan to exterminate as many Jews and other undesirables as possible, but to keep it secret and to agree code words that they were going to use and to also agree to keep all of the discussion about it out of any kind of bits of paper and communications. So it was a very important conference when it comes to the hardcore.
Yes, was it?
Orman organized the whole thing. He basically sent out the invites, but he very cleverly did not attend himself.
Go.
So he seems to me, even in 42, he was thinking, well, if I survive the war, I don't want them to be able to pin this on me.
Now, here's a question. We're talking about Martin Borman, dear listener. If you've just joined us, Tony Gosling, The Politics Show. When you said a minute, I used to work on, you still work on Radio T. The BCFM is a great station. And,
no, at the moment, no. Because of the coronavirus, we have a what they call emergency schedule, and we're online only until the emergency schedule is over. And I've not really been told how long that'll be. So we're kind of suspended from FM. So, you know, you could say the last man standing has been knocked down, but I've not quite been knocked down yet. We're definitely doing everything online. In fact, this week we did a whole hour and a half with the candidates for the election that's just been cancelled, all except from Bristol's mayor, Marvin Rees, who decided he didn't want to join us. But we had all the other candidates, four other candidates, the Tory, the Lib Dem, the Green guy, and also the Trade Union Coalition, all these people who were standing to be mayor. And this week, by the way, in 2 days' time, there was going to be an election. And what's happened is the previous mayor has got a free pass. But I thought it was well worth broadcasting that. But our managing editor obviously didn't. So we will see. Hopefully I'll be back on there once this lockdown thing is over.
Yeah, as soon as possible. We've been talking about Martin Borman, of course, who's a notorious name in 20th century history. Of course, the former private secretary. He was the private secretary to Adolf Hitler. And as Tony has just been describing, he was a genocidal maniac. Tony has been looking into for many years the idea that Borman didn't commit suicide in May of 1945, but in fact that he was spirited, he was rescued, by, well, assets of British intelligence, maybe US intelligence, because of the things he knew, because of access he had to gold bullion and securities, and in terms of billions of pounds, information he had pertaining to research and development by the Nazis. This is fascinating stuff. It's very important to be talking about this, I think, today. Okay. So here's a question. I've got to ask you this. Yep. Really important, because I'm getting abuse here now, and I deserve it. This guy who was charged with overseeing the operation to get Borman out, this guy who blew up submarines in Donegal. I went to primary school and secondary school in Ireland, and we never heard about any submarines moored or docked or just off the coast of Donegal that were blown up. You said this guy carried out this as a way of proving that he was the man to go and rescue Borman. Tell us more about that in Donegal. Fascinated by that, Dee.
All right, well, look, one of the things that John Ainsworth Davis talks about in his book, which is the actual author on the cover of the book, is Christopher Crichton, is that at the end of the war, literally the weeks after the war, both he and Ian Fleming spent several weeks going through all the documents that had been in the British military to do with their sightings of these and their reconnaissance of these U-boats in Donegal. And they went and forged loads of documents to make sure it was all covered up. And that was a large part of, in fact, you'll find that quite a lot in the book. There are various things that they have to go and do where, hang on a minute, we can't allow this to ever come out. Another one of them was the blowing up of a submarine, a Dutch submarine called KXV-11. On the 28th of November 1941, this submarine made the terrible mistake of spotting the Japanese fleet as it was heading for Pearl Harbor, and they radioed it through. You know, we've spotted this fleet going towards Pearl Harbor. Well, what he talks about in there is that he was then sent from in a Royal Navy vessel to meet up a month or so later with this submarine to give them a whole load of Christmas presents, only to be opened on Christmas Day. Well, he gave them these several boxes of presents. They took them into the submarine, and as they closed the hatch, he pressed a button, and these things all blew up, including with a whole load of poison gas capsules in them, because they wanted nobody to survive from that submarine to make a fuss after the war that they had warned everybody about Pearl Harbor happening. Of course, the reason is because they wanted Pearl Harbor to be a surprise attack at that time. You know, end of 1941, that the US public were completely against getting involved in the war. They saw it as something going on in Europe, long way away, and they needed this surprise attack on Pearl Harbor on the American ships. Of course, they'd managed to get all their most modern, up-to-date ships out of Pearl Harbor. Most of the ones in Pearl Harbor were the older ships that they didn't really mind losing so much. But it created an enormous, powerful, dramatic effect on the US public. And it brought them immediately into World War II. So, you know, this is the sort of thing that they did. They had to cover up all the documents to do, for example, with that whole raid on that submarine. So a lot of the work that they've been doing, he and Fleming spent quite a lot of time, you know, forging documents and things after the war to make sure that their trail was covered.
What a story this is, Tony, if it's true. What a story. And listeners are loving this on Twitter. And they're mentioning people like Joseph Mengele. They're mentioning Operation Paperclip. They're talking about Operation or Project Bluebeam. And there's been a brilliant comment from one of our listeners. David, I think it is. And he says, the irony that post-war, the USA was a major refuge for all of these hateful, horrible, genocidal maniacs. And then the US itself became a pro-Israeli, pro-Zionist state. That's a comment that I'm seeing quite a bit on my Twitter feed, as it were. So Project Bluebeam, Operation Paperclip, relevant, Tony, to be talking about those, you know, while we're talking about the theory that Borman was rescued.
The main take home from all of this is that by 1945, there were already movements in the West, in Britain and the US, and the big take home, of course, is that whilst many of these Nazis did indeed go to the US and the technology went to the US, that Churchill's private secretary Desmond Morton in London was actually at the heart of the operation to make that happen. So the Brits were the sort of steering hand behind it, although the US were the major beneficiaries. But the main thing here is that NATO, which was formed immediately after the Second World War, actually included many Nazis, and there is a great quote I dug out, must be, 20 years ago, from one of the top SS generals saying that NATO was formed. The original people of NATO were basically the supporters of the Nazis in the NATO countries. They were the people that actually started up NATO. And you can see how many people, I mean, Churchill after the war, for example, had to be kept off the BBC, the new television service and the old radio service, because he kept talking about wanting to nuke Moscow. You know, there was a really absolute hatred of communism, but that was already brewing during the war. So I think that there was many German units hated the idea of surrendering to the Russians. So they brought, right at the end of the war, almost all the commanders brought their people and their soldiers over to the Western Front to surrender there, because they knew if they were to surrender to the Russians, they'd be probably executed. Whereas they were already starting to do deals and making friends with the Allies.
Isn't that amazing? Tony Gosling is our guest. Thisweek.org.uk, you'll find all of this info. Tony has a brilliant timeline. I'll give you the proper. It's politicsthisweek.wordpress.com. And that's where you'll find the Martin Bormann timeline. Let me ask you this. Bit of mischief making here, Tony. You and I first spoke many moons ago about Princess Diana. I think the first time we spoke was about Princess Di. That would have been back in, I reckon, our first conversation was around about 2009. So 12 years you and me have been chin-wagging. The Duke of Edinburgh is a powerful man. And he's a Nazi. He is. Would he have been involved? Would he have had any knowledge about people like Martin Bormann, these awful men, Mengele, all these people that were basically getting let off the hook when they may have been swinging, as I said, after Nuremberg? I wonder, did the Duke of Edinburgh have anything to do with any of this?
Well, I mean, I don't know if it's fair to say that...
It is. Go ahead. It is, T. Go ahead. Say it. Go ahead.
Well, I don't know if it is fair to say that. I don't know if he is or not. But certainly, King George VI was very much aware of all this stuff I'm talking about, because he financed M section of MI6, which is basically his own private branch of MI6. And Desmond Morton, Churchill's private secretary, was his main operational commander. So, for example, John Ainsworth Davis in his book describes being brought in to see Morton one day in Whitehall and ordered in to go and see him because he was being briefed as a double agent for the Brits, spying on the Nazis. And he sat and he could hear somebody behind him. He turned around and there was the king sitting behind him. So, you know, the idea that this man or the royal family were not involved is quite obviously not true.
Fanciful, the
extent to which, for example, the Queen, the present Queen knew, you know, I think it's entirely feasible she wasn't in the loop at all. But, the other thing, of course, is with Prince Philip is he was educated by Nazis. You know, but to actually say he is a Nazi, I mean, okay, so he also said that thing about coming back, he wanted to come back as a deadly virus to reduce the world's population, didn't he? Which is a little bit of a, kind
his
of
eugenicist. His sister's married Nazis and he went to Nazi funerals. And he knew, or he must have known, what these people were up to. He is about the worst human being. You've only got to look at him, he looks like that priest, that Reverend Cain from Poltergeist 2. He's evil incarnate. And I'm not saying that for a giggle. And I do believe he was absolutely involved in the assassination of Princess Diana. I have no doubt he had some part to play in that.
So that I think, yes, you could probably almost certainly say that senior people in the royal family were aware that she was going to be bumped off. It's called the Way Ahead Group, which was exposed by John Morgan before he died, that this group was meeting every 6 months and it had a special meeting just before the death of Diana. These are senior royals and their private secretaries, who basically the Way Ahead Group's job was to manage threats to the royal family. And what happened, in the last year or so of her life after the divorce was she became a threat. She became basically a reputational threat to the royal family. And they were completely at sixes and sevens about what to do about it, because she was on many of the newspapers. They'd done everything they could to get her bad press as much as they could. But still, some of the tabloids had pictures of her in a positive way. And then, of course, there was Andrew Morton's book. Yeah. Which came out, Diana, Her True Story, which then showed just what a terrible husband Prince Charles had been to her, and how she was entirely the victim. And she actually started getting better. She started to get much more confident after she went to a party at Camilla's sister, I think it was, house with Prince Charles, where Camilla was as well. And she confronted Camilla in the middle of the party and said, "What do you think you're doing with my husband? Get away from him." And, Camilla, but once she'd done that, she'd had the confidence to do that at a private party, but in public in front of people, she got a great deal more confidence. And then they relied, I suppose, on keeping her down, Richie, on actually smashing her spirit, but she rose up against it. And the fact that she started successfully fighting back just by being a beautiful, honest person, she had to go, I guess. That's what the Way Ahead group decided.
Yeah, she had to go. Noel Botham, again, somebody who you would have been intimately acquainted with, a lovely gentleman, rest in peace. Noel wrote some amazing books about Princess Diana. This is going all over the place. It's really fascinating. I think why I've loved speaking with you for the last 12 years, and I mean that. One of the things that I think about Princess Diana is I think about Bill Clinton and the verbal promise she'd gotten from old Bill to basically end the manufacture of landmines globally. And I always believe that that played some part in her downfall, because that couldn't be allowed to happen. What do you think, T?
Definitely, yeah. Nicholas Soames apparently phoned her up because one of her friends overheard the conversation. Old Tory grandee basically threatening her, saying, "Look, unless you back off from this program, bad things are going to happen to you." And that's in one of the documentaries, although, of course, probably the key documentary of all of them is the one made by Keith Allen.
Yeah, it's brilliant.
Unlawful Killing, I think it is, which is so-called banned everywhere, because the royal family has taken out, saying that they want to have, I think, is it 50 edits in the film?
That's
now,
right, 50, yeah.
Free press.
Yeah, 50. They wanted all mention of Philip taken out. I want to read you something very briefly. Jean Anne, the great Jean Anne, a huge help to me, Tony, has sent me a few lines from the late, great Jim Marr's book, The Rise of the Fourth Reich. Rest in peace, Jim Marr. Jim wrote, "When Martin Bormann's wife was captured in a small hotel in northern Italy, she had 2,200 antique gold coins in her possession. Bormann himself sent gold coins to Argentina by submarine, where on arrival his treasure was placed under the personal protection of Evita Peron." And the wife, Bormann's wife, allegedly died of mercury poisoning even in March of 1946. This is some story, Tony, eh?
Well, I think it's one of the biggest stories, really.
Yes.
Running into the spine of history, really, because the other thing is it connects Morton back to the First World War as well. I mean, we haven't even mentioned Edward VIII, who was king, but he was also very pro-Nazi just before the war. This royal family, I think there needs to be some serious questions about them. They changed their name, didn't they, at the time of the First World War, from Saxe-Coburg-Gotha, because the Goethe bombers were coming over and dropping bombs on our soldiers. So we can't have a king with the same name as the bombers that are coming and killing our men. There's so many. I mean, what, for example, with Edward VIII, some brilliant work's been done on him, and it's quite clear now that over in Lisbon, where he was over in Lisbon, he actually was talking to the ambassador to Portugal from Nazi Germany, desperately trying to persuade him to start bombing London, to actually start the Blitz. This is back in 1940, because they had this thing called the Phony War for the first 6 or 8 months of the war. And lo and behold, 2 weeks later, the first bombs fell on London.
Hang on a second. So, now, you're saying that Churchill's secretary, Morton, was in Lisbon urging...
Oh, no. That's Edward VIII.
Excuse me, Edward VIII. Sorry.
We've got two things going on here.
Yeah, I'm all over. No, it's my fault. I'm a bit warm in studio. I'm a bit warm in studio.
Me too.
But that's bad enough. That's bad enough.
Edward VIII. After he abdicated, was Wallace Simpson was a Nazi agent, and they were actively trying to get and succeeded in getting the Nazi high command to start bombing London, because they were a bit reluctant. They're saying, well, actually, you know, we'd quite like to have an alliance with Britain, blah, blah. The other thing I was saying about Morton was that he was the aide-de-camp to General Haig in the First World War. So he was actually intimately involved in the mass slaughter, the horrendous, ridiculous trench warfare. Mm. And Haig, who was this figure apparently who never ever gave an opinion, he only ever gave orders. He'd say, right, bomb. And then no one could ever ask him, question him about anything. I mean, he's portrayed brilliantly in that Richard Attenborough film, Oh, What a Lovely War, from 1969, right from the middle of the sort of great season of brilliant films. And, you know, Haig was, Morton was working for him. Now, in Second World War, he was working for Churchill. But in between times, he did things like, for example, Morton was behind the Zinoviev letter, which was an attempt, well, it was a very successful attempt to scupper the Labour Party's chances of winning a general election between the wars. And it was a complete forgery made up by Morton. Morton also, incidentally, lived literally, and I've been down there in Kent near Crockham Hill and Chartwell, which is where Churchill lived, literally only about 30 or 40 minutes walk away from Winston Churchill. And they both bought houses down there. Early Lands in Crockham Hill was Morton's house, and Chartwell, just near Westerham, was Churchill's house at the same time. Actually, Morton moved in before Churchill did. So one wonders, Richie, who was really in charge?
Who was really in charge? Hidden History with Tony Gosling on the Richie Allen Radio Show, live from Salford, 23 minutes past 6, Europe's most listened to independent radio show. That sounds like an idle boasty. It's not. You've got to sing when you're winning. I might have no listeners tomorrow, so we'll brag today. Tony is a proper journalist. With a terrific resume. Let's hope that he's back behind the microphone at BCFM real soon, presenting the politics show, which is absolutely fantastic. Would Israeli intelligence have known that these bastards, these murderous, mindless bastards, were being spirited out of Germany and sent to the United States? And if they did, why didn't they do anything about it at the time? I'm not trying to have a cheap shot at Israel. I do that most days. I have no time for Israel as a state. That's, of course, a very different thing. It's a hugely different thing when it comes to talking about Jews. Jews are Zionists. I have no problem with Jews. Zionists I don't see eye to eye with. They must have known it, Tony. What the bloody hell was going on with Israeli intelligence?
Well, great question. And of course, they did know. Just quickly, though, I will say we are doing the politics show online only. So if you go to thisweek.org.uk, you can find it there. It's definitely worth having. This is probably, it's getting even more fiery now we've been taken off of FM.
But
anyway,
look,
back to the creation of the State of Israel and Israeli intelligence, because this was never a done deal. I mean, of course, you know that the Israeli state was formed basically by terrorists, people who were killing loads of Arabs, killing loads of Brits, and trying to create their own state. But it was by no means guaranteed that the UN was going to award them a state. They were umming and ahhing. They were saying, well, hang on, these guys are actually just a bunch of thugs and killers. We shouldn't reward them by giving them their own state, no matter if they're Zionists or not. But there was a whole kind of load of negotiations that went on before Israel finally became a state, was awarded such in 1947, on 29th of November. There was a vote at the United Nations, and that was delivered by Nelson Rockefeller, who delivered the crucial Latin American votes for the Zionists. After very, very heated negotiations with the people who were putting it all together, David Ben-Gurion, who was the first prime minister, and Reuven Shiloh, he was the intelligence chief, really, that set up the Mossad after Israel was created. And the UN just about recognized the State of Israel with a few votes that Nelson Rockefeller had pulled in from the Latin American countries where he had a lot of influence. So, but the thing is, what was the quid pro quo? What did they get in return? What did Nelson Rockefeller demand to deliver those votes? Well, he said, actually, Rockefeller says, you can have vengeance to Ben-Gurion, or you can have a country, but you can't have both. And that's an actual quote from John Loftus's book, Secret War Against the Jews. And I interviewed him, well, must be a year or so ago, maybe a bit less, about that. And he's been through, the thing with John Loftus is a very interesting figure.
Lovely man, John. Lovely man. I interviewed John years ago. Lovely guy.
Because he was awarded this amazing status of FBI Special Investigator by Jimmy Carter to go through all the files. He had access to absolutely everything, including the nuclear files. And so he got to see just about everything in the US that had never been released. And Carter said to him, look, I want you to just, you know, no holds barred, warts and all, tell me what's in there. And so, you know, he's one of those people I think is just a one in a million, really, that's had access to this. So he makes it absolutely clear that the original founders of the Israeli state were told either you shut up about the Nazis, because, of course, the Americans had hundreds, if not thousands, of ex-Nazis working in their intelligence services already and their scientific services, and were intending to use all these people in the what eventually became the space program, etc. So they said, look, if you can get a country, but you better never speak about this again. And this is why when Adolf Eichmann was kidnapped and brought over to Israel, there was a big hoo-ha about this at the time. That is, it happened in May 1960. Eichmann, yeah. Basically the agreement was broken. The Israelis said, no, we're going to have Eichmann. He was one of the main people behind the Final Solution. And at the time, there was a lot of suggestion as well, well, we've got Eichmann, what about Bormann? And of course, and that was 1960, but it was by 1972, they discovered who Bormann was. And I definitely recommend you, if you can share that photograph of Bormann taken by Ladislas Farago in 1972.
I will, you tweeted, you tweeted and I'll retweet it. You've got thousands of Twitter followers as well. Let me just read you two quotes. Two very quick quotes from Jim's book, The Rise of the Fourth Reich, which I haven't read for years, but I have read it. In 1943, Bormann gained total control over both the Nazi Party and the German economy, including all top secret technology, incredibly. And Jim goes on to write, and Hitler said of Bormann, I know he is brutal, but what he undertakes, he finishes. I can absolutely rely on that. With his ruthlessness and brutality, he always sees out, he sees that my orders are carried out. Bormann reigns supreme.
Okay, I'll give you another quote.
Wow.
And this I was reading the other night about Bormann, is that Hitler, when people used to question saying, well, Bormann, you know, isn't he kind of a bit problematic? This is people like Goering, etc., who were having trouble. They didn't trust Bormann at all. Hitler would bang his fist on the same table and say, I need Bormann to win this war. He's the one that will deliver it, you know. So he was basically, Hitler had an immense amount of confidence in him. And that may be because Bormann knew a few secrets about Hitler's life before the war. And, you know, so in a way that Hitler was beholden to Bormann. Because he didn't want Bormann to leak any secrets of his pre-war life. For example, you know, there's a lot of evidence out there that he actually murdered his niece because his niece, he was having a relationship with her, and she demanded to split up with Hitler, and then she was found dead. So, you know, and Bormann was one of the people who apparently had investigated that crime. So it looks to me as if, Bormann was a kind of mafia figure who just wanted to do whatever he wanted to do for himself. And he was an extremely selfish, pig-headed guy who just so happened to see the Second World War as a massive opportunity to do deals with some of the great powers in the world to make as much money as he possibly could, and prestige as well. I think to a certain extent, these people see themselves as really smart to be able to pull the wool over everyone's eyes. And my job and your job and any normal journalist's job should be to actually pull the wool up from people's eyes so we can see some of the hidden wiring behind these wars. And the interesting thing about Morton is he joins a lot of the dots of these two world wars together, having been the aide-de-camp for General Haig and then also a private secretary for Winston Churchill, no less, right the way from, you know, well before the war until the very end.
And you make a compelling case on the website, and you've been looking into it for years. You make a very compelling case by drawing together these these historical events in it. And, because that's what you do. And saying, well, look at these events. Look what happened here. Knitting together these strands to make a very compelling case that Bormann was taken out of Germany.
The other thing is Ian Fleming's involvement. I mean, I think it's fascinating. Yeah. I was only just hearing Lucy Fleming, his niece, on the radio yesterday. But he, it seems, after the war, he was very depressed because he'd seen how things had gone. Suddenly, you know, he's been involved in this operation. Basically, they were conned. They were told, well, Bormann is going to we're going to get Bormann over here, and then all this money is going to be given back to the countries and the people that it was, that it was stolen from by the Nazis. And over the months and years after World War II, people like John Ainsworth Davis and Ian Fleming realised, well, actually, this has not happened. This money's just been disappeared. I mean, the money trail now looks as if it went mostly to South America, and also the money was laundered through Sullivan and Cromwell law firm in New York, which was the Dulles brothers law firm. Of course, those two were extremely powerful after World War II. One was Secretary of State. The other was the first head of the CIA, exactly. And those two people basically were in charge of the intelligence service post-war and the foreign policy. But there they were laundering all this money week after week after week using their New York law firm. I mean, there's a whole nother angle story to that. But, you know, I think if you go back to look at Morton particularly, you know, he's almost an unknown figure. During the war, he was a completely secret figure. He'd worked in intelligence between the wars. He'd also run something called the Political Intelligence Unit and Political Warfare Unit between the wars. These shadowy organizations that really aren't supposed to exist.
Yeah.
And he, to me, in some ways, comes out as the demon figure, the sort of Aleister Crowley figure in the background, who sees the war as an opportunity to make a lot of money and also to basically line the pockets of the Fourth Reich mafia once the war's finished.
I'm absolutely gobsmacked. I've been doing all the reading in the world, obviously, leading into this, you know, and shaking my head because I've learned so much in the last few days, even this afternoon, reading the website, reading your own website. It's incredible. I've put links on Twitter to where people can go and read this in black and white. Brilliant to have Tony talking about it. We're going to leave it for a minute, but Tony's not going anywhere. We've got about 15 minutes left in this program. I wanted to bring us back to May 2020. And, the continuing pandemic saga news today. We've heard Patrick Vallance on television today saying that the lockdown's not going to be ending anytime soon. The 2 metre distance between people has to continue. The Premier League's not going to start anytime soon. There will be football played for the next 12 months, by all accounts, behind closed doors. What I think, Tony, you talk about the Fourth Reich. Okay, we haven't been sent to concentration camps. We're not being worked to death or machine gunned to death and bulldozed into trenches. But this is a tyranny, I believe, that is being imposed on the people of this country and elsewhere around the world. How do you feel about it now?
Okay, look, I mean, I think you need, there's been lies, damn lies and statistics, haven't there? I mean, for example, today we've had news that 32,000 people died of COVID-19 in Britain, and it's the highest death toll in Europe. Hang on, let's just roll back a minute. Those people didn't die they died with COVID-19. So this is one ingredient in their death, and you cannot equate the two. It's one or the other. Either they had no pre-existing symptoms or conditions, in which case they did die of COVID-19, or else it's been a contributor to their death. So I think if you're looking at the number of people who've died with pre-existing conditions, you're looking about, you know, let's call around about one third of the actual total have died. I mean, this is just a bit of a guess, really, but it certainly isn't the main total. If you're looking at the lethality of this disease from the best studied countries and regions, it's around about somewhere between, some scientists say 0.1% and 0.37%, which is around about the same range as a very severe or severe flu. We had 50,000 extra deaths in Britain between 2017 and the winter of 2017-2018, and now we've had something like 10,000 deaths from COVID-19 so far. There's the other side of all of this, which is that it looks to me, as and we've just had more evidence of this yesterday from France, that this this virus was actually quite widespread in Britain and in the US and France. We've heard from the Icelandics that their first cases in January had come from the Alps and come from the UK. Yeah. Not from China. So it looks to me as if Britain and the US and other countries were much further down the line with this virus before it was even recognised, Richard.
I had it, Tony. I'm sure I had it. I was in a very bad way in late January. It was so bad. I don't want to come across sounding like the scarecrow Boris Johnson, but I was in a bad place. I'm a very fit bloke. I've never in my life smoked, but I've had lung and chest problems intermittently over the years. And I was in a really bad state in late January. And they couldn't figure it out as a surgery. They said, we can see you're in great distress that you can't breathe easily, but there isn't any fluid or any mucus. And I could not get a breath. It was scary stuff to you. And they were giving me very strong steroids to take, and they weren't doing much good either. And I think it's only my experience of being, you know, asthmatic and having these problems over the years, when sometimes they got bad, and I've had double pneumonia, believe it or not, twice in my life. That's no joke either. I think that's what got me through. I managed to keep calm. The oft-mentioned other half, Caroline, was terrified. There were nights when it was dreadfully bad. I was off from the show for 3.5 weeks. I think I had it, T, whatever it is. I think I had it, and
well, I had something similar in the end of December too. I mean, I was in bed for 3.5 days, dosed up with paracetamol and aspirin, very high temperature. I didn't really know when they first started talking about dry cough. I'd never had one really like that before, where you're coughing and coughing, but you're not really coughing anything up. You know, I had that for 2 weeks after every evening. You know, and it's just like, you know, please can I go to sleep? I just keep coughing, you know. And so that was for 2 weeks afterwards. So I had, you know, basically 2.5 weeks of horrible stuff at the end of December. No idea, because, of course, it didn't exist then, did it?
No, it didn't exist then. And it makes sense now when you listen to Professor Hennigan, evidence-based medicine at Oxford. It makes more and more sense what he said, that whatever this is, once it was known, what should have happened was people that might be vulnerable to it, like me, even though I'm a young, healthy man, we should have started on the vitamin D and vitamin C, and we should have been careful indoors. But locking down 99% of everybody else who's healthy and who wouldn't even know they had it, or they might, like you, get that nasty cough and be unwell and physically sick for a couple of weeks, locking everybody else down was crazy. And Tony, the damage, 3,000 Virgin Air, whatever it's called, employees gone. Right, you might, I don't mean you, but people might despise Branson. There's good reasons, fair enough. Tony, the damage that this is going to do, mate, to ordinary people in the next 12 months to 2 years. Most people, I don't think, have a clue just how bad this recession is going to be. What do you think?
Well, it's not just you and I. There's loads of people out there. When I first started talking about, once the symptoms were really talked about, in the mass media,
yeah.
And I said, well, hang on, I had this. There's now 7 or 8 people in Bristol I've spoken to who also had something. I mean, we're not talking about Facebook friends, people I know face to face. And also, interestingly, the BBC Natural History Unit had been filming abroad and came back, and there were 4 of them that went down with it on the 17th of December, 2019. So, you know, this is one of the reasons I'm very, very suspicious about the way this is being dealt with, Richie. I just don't think that there's any kind of realistic understanding that actually it's potentially originated somewhere completely different from China, and that it's just that when it reached China, when it reached Wuhan particularly, that's when all the media and all the pandemonium and the hysteria started. Look, the other thing is, how lethal is this compared to normal flu? Well, it's a bit more lethal than normal flu, particularly because it's passed around so easily. It's definitely a novel coronavirus, but coronavirus is something which carries the common cold. There is this thing called the pandemic scale, which is rather like the Beaufort scale is, you know, for wind, like gale force, hurricane force and all that. But actually, this only comes out at category 2 on there. which is, it goes up to category 5. So this is, you know, this is a very mild pandemic according to that scale, where they say only voluntary isolation of particularly sick people is envisaged as the main measure, when that scale was invented. If you were to take the current pandemic's, you know, death rates, and look at that. So very, very peculiar and particularly weird is this whole idea in Britain that we're going to be saved by this app and by mandatory vaccination. The app, for example, you know, how many really elderly people do you know with a smartphone? It just doesn't make sense.
It doesn't make sense.
They haven't thought this through at all. But I think that they're all pinning all their hopes on Bill Gates and his wonderful vaccine. And we all know, well, most of us know, although the mass media have told us about Bill Gates and his incredible successes with the vaccines killing
and
sterilizing people around the world.
I wonder, I like your more kind of a broad look at things without jumping in with 2 feet. I've always enjoyed that about you. You look at any theory. What about the theory that, you know, people have used this phrase they've coined, plandemic? Namely, that it is some sort of bioweapon and its purpose is to convince people that the world must change and that from now on in, we must get used to being vaccinated for things to enable us to go about our daily business. I'm beginning to think that's a very plausible theory. Of course, I can't prove it, but it makes sense to me. Go ahead.
Okay, well, one of the things I came across when I was over in New Zealand was the fact that over there, there were quite a lot of health, you know, professionals, doctors, nurses, etc., working in care homes, etc., that didn't want to have the flu vaccine. Obviously, if they caught flu, they'd stay away from work, etc., but they didn't actually believe the vaccine was the right thing to do, that it was worse for their health.
Yeah.
And so it was only a quite low take-up amongst people that know about health of the flu vaccine in New Zealand. So what they did is they said anyone who comes into work who hasn't had the flu vaccine, doctors, nurses or any staff, has to wear a face mask. And do you know how long it took them to have the vaccine, Richie?
Go on.
2 or 3 months. And almost every healthcare worker in New Zealand had had the flu vaccine because they didn't want to have to wear a face mask every day at work. So this is how they're doing it, by various forms of coercion. And I just think we need to kind of resist the silly idea, for example, that everybody has got to walk around with a face mask on. That isn't going to make any difference whatsoever if you've already had the illness, has it, for example? And what we're saying now is that, oh, well, we're not testing anybody, so you're never going to be able to know whether you had it. So you're just on the precautionary principle. You've got to have the mandatory vaccine. You've got to have the ID 2020, the digital ID.
Yeah.
You've got to walk around with a face mask, blah, blah. So basically, we're moving over to the presumption of guilt, basically, and also away from the most important principle in medicine, which is called informed consent. You decide what happens to your body.
So
I can see a mass, resistance to this starting up against the idea of you know, an ID that you have to use to access public transport, etc., where you've got to show you've been vaccinated, because I think there are the Brits are, you know, a truculent lot. And they're not just going to go and have a vaccine because they're told to, although the Germans might. In fact, there's a lot of, you know, Matt Hancock back in September was talking about, oh, we must have mandatory vaccination in Britain.
That's right, he was,
He was talking at the time about doing it to children. And now we know that the COVID-19 hardly affects kids at all. So what are you going to do? Ah, right, he's changed his mind last night. Oh, well, children are not really important. We're going to have to make sure it's all the old people that get it. Well, there's a lot of old people that don't want to do this, and I don't think he's going to get anywhere if he tries to go down this mandatory vaccination route. And all he's going to do with this app, I think, contact tracing, is alienate even more people because they don't trust this app, and hardly anyone's going to download it. There's a tremendous amount of evidence that they're just trying to follow the Bill Gates agenda here, and of course, you know, the funding by Bill Gates of Imperial College's survey, which was the thing that tipped Boris Johnson, saying no, we're not going to go for herd immunity in Britain, we're going to go for lockdown. An infinite lockdown. They've got no exit strategy, Richie. No exit strategy.
None whatsoever. Let me put a counter argument. Let's make this final question for today. Let me put a counter argument to your characterization of the Brits as truculent. Here's the counter-argument. In fact, it's Hayden Hewitt's argument. That's liveleak.com's Hayden Hewitt, triggerwarning.tv. Hayden made a good point in a conversation with me on the Dog and Bone yesterday. He said, Richie, I know your audience, he said, will be, I'm not having that. They'll bring in this vaccine. I'm not having it. But he said, Richie, look, you'll have relatives down the country, senior relatives. You'll have relatives overseas. You'll have your lifestyle. You'll have your, you know, I like to go to the theatre. I like to go to the cinema. You'll have all of this. He mentioned the coercion that you mentioned earlier. Great word. And he said, don't be surprised if people whom you wouldn't have imagined would have acquiesced and taken up the offer of the vaccine will do it because of that. And I got to thinking of, again, the oft-mentioned future Mrs. Allen, wonderful woman with beautiful family members in Nancy in the northeast of France, you know, a young but you know, maturing mother, a grandmother who's 98, whom she loves. She has the same feelings as I do about vaccines. But I think maybe in 6 or 8 months' time, she might find herself having no choice, T.
Okay, so you can, if it's, surely, if you have the vaccine, that doesn't make you any less likely that you're going to be immune to this if
of course.
You believe what you're being told about reinfection, which personally I don't believe. I mean, what we've seen from Iceland and from Sweden is they're saying, well, no, people are not getting in any kind of reinfection. But at the end of the day, there's been a horrendous amount of hysteria around this, and lots of elderly people are extremely frightened. They think that this is far, far worse than flu. They're being convinced that it's an absolute horrible killer disease. It is a little bit worse than a bad flu, but not a lot worse. And actually, many of those people have got other conditions who are being told about. You notice on the news, for example, the only people they're really reporting on, generally speaking, are middle-aged and young people. So when one of those dies, it gets a massive amplification. This is extremely frightening. This is what is one of the reasons why I think the media, once again, just like 9/11, is absolutely culpable on scaring many, many people into thinking, God, we've got to do something, you know, peculiar and particularly special about this virus. Actually, really what we need to do is follow, I think, is Sweden's lead, even though not following them down the road of digital IDs and implanting
cashless society as well, Do you know?
Cashless society.
Do you know, Tommy?
But we need to be following that basic idea that we need to just make sure the young people have got herd immunity. Let me just tell you one little thing. When I was over in New Zealand, they say, oh, this immunity doesn't last, right? They're talking about that time and time again, even with flu. When there was the original pandemic, the Spanish flu back in 1918, the indigenous people in the Maoris over in New Zealand had 7 times more casualties. People died in their population than in the white population. Why? Because even though they didn't necessarily had a bad flu, a lot of the white people had it in their bloodstream from their parents even. So it has an incredible amount of efficacy. In the past, if one of your ancestors has had one of these nasty viruses, it might well help you survive. It didn't help the Maoris, but you know, this is the opposite of what we're being told. So I'm convinced a lot of that is just strategic lying, Richie.
I think you're right. And as usual, I don't keep as calm as you and as, as circumspect. I see it being just evil beyond belief. There's an agenda, I believe, to change human experience as we know it. I do believe in a transhumanist agenda. I've spoken to some very, very good people about that over the years, including scientists from, you know, some very respected universities in the United States. It's terrible, this. We see the patented stuff. It's all there if people want to see it. The MIT papers written for Bill Gates and his cohorts, this digital vaccine that leaves the tattoo that can be read digitally by the smartphones. It's sickening stuff, Tony. It really is. And I think coercion is the buzzword today. A lot of our listeners are in agreement with you, and they don't like to be in agreement with Hayden. They love Hayden, but they don't like agreeing with him because he doesn't share a lot of their opinions. But they,
well, okay, so the Gates Foundation, I think, is a perfect example of the sort of thing that should be smashed into little pieces. I mean, you know, it's exactly analogous, really. I mean, I think it was David Livingstone, the guy who's the author of Transhumanism, The History of a Dangerous Idea, which all of your listeners should get and read.
Many of them have.
It's really interesting. It's basically the new fascism. This is what we're dealing with, these people. And the Gates Foundation, the Rockefeller Foundation, what David Livingstone said is Bill Gates is the new Rockefeller, because Rockefeller monopolized, using all sorts of dark tactics, dirty tricks, the oil industry in America by what they call vertical integration, where he just controlled everything, the petrol stations, oil fields, refineries, and he used all sorts of dirty tricks to control the whole market in the US during the time of the First World War. And that there was an attempt to break up the Rockefeller Standard Oil Empire, but that was a failure, really, because he kept all the shares. He just ran various different companies, ExxonMobil and the rest. But what Gates has done is he's done exactly the same sort of thing using Windows and Microsoft, you know, and which controls Skype, which we're talking on now.
That's
you
right.
know, they are everywhere, Richie. They are everywhere. And these monopolists take their profits and they pay no tax whatsoever. And instead they use it through these so-called wonderful foundations like the Gates Foundation to get Imperial College and the Johns Hopkins University to tell our government, give our government presentations on what they have to do when COVID-19 comes along. And all that they're really after is to get their vaccines out there. And, of course, they get absolutely millions and millions and millions. They make a fantastic amount of money out of these. But not only that, they get power. They get the power to stick into you whatever they want.
The politics show will be on air this week. It's online at the moment as BCFM, like everybody else, is on hiatus because of the lockdown. Thisweek.org.uk is where you'll find out about the politics show. I doubt you haven't heard, I'm sure you've heard of it, but if you're new to Tony, if you've just tuned into this program, you've not heard Tony before, check him out. It's terrific. It's online this week and hopefully you'll be back on the studio. You'll be in the studio again real soon because your program is vital. I enjoy listening to it and I do steal from it. I nick from it from time to time. But I always give you credit as is the case.
Yeah, that's the idea. People can steal anything.
Give you credit though.
Okay. I mean, we did a review of the Planet of the Humans film as well this week, which is just out by Michael Moore's latest film, which has caused immense ructions in the green community. All these green people.
It has, hasn't it?
Greenies that thought that they were supporting something good have suddenly found out, actually the people that we've been supporting all these years, oh my God, they're building wood-fired power stations. Oh my God, and they're cutting down all the forest and the rainforest to fire, and we've been supporting them. But you know what, Richie? Very few of them want to actually admit that what they've done has been suckered. And so, of course, they go, oh, this is a terrible film. It's a very dangerous film. You see that all over the place. But actually, it's a brilliant film. It's well worth watching.
Do you know
why, Tony? Fairly low budget, but it's absolute mind-blower. And I think it's one of those things that will really make you think about, it's incredible the extent to which people can be hoodwinked.
Do you know why they can't take a step back, people? Because the biggest plague afflicting humanity at the moment isn't the coronavirus. It's identity politics. That's what it is, in my opinion. I've been reading and even writing on my own website over the last years about identity politics. Look, we could talk about that all day long, and we will do another day. The Borman report was absolutely fascinating, Tony. Well put together, mate. A lot of food for thought there. It's, you said to me, oh, jump in and put it to me. And I thought, no, I won't, because it's theory, but it's theory backed up by wonderful circumstantial evidence. It's a great report, I really appreciate it.
What makes, for me, makes really good radio is what you've prompted today, which is me putting two and two together live as we're chatting about the two main occasions where this whole idea of Bormann's body being discovered in Berlin was, firstly, when Stuart Stephen and Ladislaus Farago had this Daily Express front page headline, Martin Bormann Alive. Literally within the next week or so, they'd suddenly discovered his body.
That's
in Berlin. Isn't that amazing coincidence? And the second time being upon the publication of the absolutely mind-blowing and brilliant, once you started it, I guarantee you won't stop reading. It's called OpJB, The Last Great Secret of the Second World War. I'm just going to flick to the front cover to see. It's 19... 96 that was published, and it was literally again a couple of weeks after that was published that we got another load of stuff saying, oh, Borman's skull has been discovered, blah blah blah. And the other thing to mention is that this marked the beginning of a load of sort of counter wave of books coming out saying, oh, Adolf Hitler has survived, Grey Wolf, and the rest of them.
Yeah.
Actually, they were, I believe, they were simply another strategic lie operation in order to divert attention from the fact it was Bormann that survived. Basically, Hitler had run out of steam by the end of the war. You know, he had nothing left. He was on drugs and things to try and keep him going. And he actually wanted to die. It's just some kind of like sacrificial death. That's the way he saw himself. Bormann, by the way, was the one who was entrusted with his will and brought it to London.
That's right. The details
about that as well. So,
misinformation, you know, put out there about Hitler to obscure the truth about Bormann. Mate, I could talk to you all night long. You know that's true. I mean that. We're just about out of time. By the way, Tony is on Twitter, at Tony Gosling. There's only one, at Tony Gosling. Thisweek.org.uk. And I've tweeted a link to the Bormann report, politicsthisweek.wordpress.com. It's Martin Bormann and the Nazi Gold. A tonic, mate. I had a great tonic last night with Mark Bajerski, and had another one tonight with you. Thanks for coming on, and I know you'll be back on again real soon, Tony. Thank you.
We certainly will, Richie. God bless. Thanks very much.
You too, buddy. Thanks for that. Again, folks, the Politics Show will be online this week, thisweek.org.uk, not from the studio, but they're doing it online. You've just been listening to my pal, the great Tony Gosling, live from Bristol. Thanks for listening to us. Thanks for all your tweets. There's a great conversation going on there on Twitter, not only about Bormann, but about the circumstances surrounding other prominent Nazis and how they got into Europe and into the UK and, of course, into the United States. Really enjoyed that conversation.